A federal prison in New Jersey has the highest number of cases of COVID-19 of all federal facilities, and incarcerated people are feeling helpless.
I woke up in my sleep hyperventilating and sweating and stuff, and I went to the officer, and I'm like, yo, you gotta get me out of here. I can't breathe. And he told me to tough it out.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, December 3rd, a look at COVID-19 in prisons and jails throughout the country and whether a vaccine will reach incarcerated people. Also, a look at how right-wing political organizations are trying to reach Latino voters in Georgia in the lead-up to the runoff elections. And then we take a big look at romantic relationships amid the pandemic, and we hear from you.
I haven't hugged anybody in 7 months.
We really sparked just with like our connection between our eyes.
I have no romantic life and would love a relationship, but just gave up during the pandemic.
But first, this week, a panel of CDC advisors voted on recommendations to determine who should get top priority once a COVID-19 vaccine is rolled out. Under these guidelines, healthcare workers and the elderly in long-term care facilities would get access to a vaccine first, and they would be followed by a group of essential workers, from transportation workers to teachers and corrections officers. Many of the people incarcerated in the prisons where those officers work, however, would not be prioritized under the CDC recommendations. And that's despite the fact that at least 200,000 people in jails and prisons across the country have contracted COVID-19 during the pandemic. And in federal prisons, many incarcerated people say that health protections have been alarmingly inadequate.
I woke up in my sleep hyperventilating and sweating and stuff, and I went to the officer, and I'm like, yo, you gotta get me out of here. I can't breathe. Something's wrong with me. And he told me to tough it out. It was like 2 in the morning. He said, you got to tough it out.
That's a 35-year-old man who's currently incarcerated in New Jersey's Fort Dix prison. He recently spoke with WNYC reporter Karen Yee and asked that his name be withheld. Fort Dix is experiencing the worst COVID-19 outbreak of any federal prison in the United States. According to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, 289 people incarcerated at Fort Dix and 28 staff members have tested positive for the virus, though the Bureau also says that no one at Fort Dix has died from the virus. Here to discuss the Fort Dix coronavirus outbreak is Karen Yee, a reporter covering New Jersey for WNYC. Karen, thanks for being with us.
Hi, good to be here.
How did the outbreak at Fort Dix begin?
So there were a couple of cases in the spring of COVID. I think it went up to 40 at some point. And over the summer, we saw those numbers come down. But then in October, we started to see those numbers creep up back again. And what we've sort of pieced together between speaking to people inside the prison, family members, and court records is it could have been either a big transfer of prisoners from an Ohio prison. There was a huge outbreak in Ohio, and about 300 prisoners were transferred to Fort Dix in late September, and some of them had tested positive. So the BOP says they were properly quarantined, but it's unclear if maybe some of those prisoners could have given the virus to the general population at Fort Dix. Also around the same time, you had cases in New Jersey spiking and correctional officers coming in and out of the prisons. And you also had visits resuming temporarily for a few weeks. So any of those ways, the virus could have come into the prison. And you saw in October, in one day, cases tripling overnight from 50 to 200, and it sort of kept growing from there.
We reached out to the Bureau of Prisons, and in a statement, they told us that they provide, quote, appropriate treatment to anyone who tests positive for COVID-19 in its prisons. But in interviews with WNYC that you've conducted, people who are in Fort Dix and their family members described testing positive for the virus and then being left for hours in rooms with others who were negative. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. So the BOP has a policy and procedure as to what happens when somebody tests positive. But in practice, that's a lot more complicated, right? Because at Fort Dix specifically, these are dorm-style military barracks. So you have 12 men to a room, 300 in a building. And so often you have people quarantining who are positive on one floor, negative on the other. You find out you're positive and it takes a few hours to move you to a quarantine or an isolation unit. You also have issues with the men sharing a lot of common spaces because this is a low security prison. Generally, there's a lot more movement and flexibility. They share bathrooms on the same floor. So you have 80 men using the same bathrooms, the same sinks, the same showers, bunk beds. So there is, generally in prison, social distance is nearly impossible, particularly in Fort Dix, because of the setup, it's even more impossible.
What about the personal protective equipment, things like masks? Are those provided for the prisoners? And are there adequate places to wash your hands, for example, or hand sanitizer?
So masks were mandated in April by the Bureau of Prisons, and the prisoners say that they have received masks. They receive cloth masks 2 generally a week. The issue is, you know, they get dirty, they get soiled, and when they're being washed, they have nothing to wear. Some of the complaints that I've also heard from family members of those incarcerated and those inside is that the guards aren't always wearing the masks when they come in, and if they're moving between buildings, that becomes a concern. In terms of disinfectants and cleaning supplies, a lot of them have complained about this not happening. I mean, the BOP has said areas are thoroughly cleansed if somebody tests positive. Prisoners have said flat out, that's not happening. We're not seeing that. We're begging for cleaning supplies. We're not getting it. In one quarantine unit where at one point most of the inmates, 218 out of 231 from the last court records I saw, had tested positive, a lot of the people in there were complaining about an infestation of gnats, you know, things not being cleaned, toilets not being cleaned. These are, again, shared spaces. In terms of soap, the BOP has said they do provide soap if they can't afford it through commissary. Again, the inmates have said a lot of the soap dispensers are routinely empty.
Karen, there's been a lot of talk about a vaccine. And of course, now there isn't just talk about a vaccine, but there's movement toward actually getting a vaccine in the hands of American citizens in terms of priority. When you were doing your reporting at Fort Dix, were any of the incarcerated people you spoke to aware of a vaccine? And how did they have any feelings about whether or not they wanted to take a vaccine?
That's not something that came up. The vaccine conversation has really picked up sort of in the last couple of weeks. I think the biggest concern from those incarcerated is sort of immediate medical care. Like, that is what they are desperate for. I think the reality is a lot of the people inside Fort Dix, about 2,700, are going to ride out the pandemic in there. I mean, there are 2 ways to get out of prison. There's home confinement and there's compassionate release. Not everyone is eligible. So they're not necessarily pushing to get a vaccine. From what I heard, they're sort of pushing to get very basic medical care. See a doctor, see a nurse, get access to their medical records, get more than Tylenol. Those very basic steps. That's really what the conditions that they want to change right now.
Karen, you also spoke with family members of people who are incarcerated at Fort Dix. And here's what Karen Gasper, whose son Chris is incarcerated there and tested positive for COVID-19, had to say to you.
I feel helpless. I feel totally helpless. I mean, my son calls me and says, Mom, just give up on me. He said, because I don't think I'm ever coming home. I mean, he doesn't even call his children anymore because he said, you know, I don't want to give them some kind of false hope. It breaks my heart.
How typical is that, Karen, for family members who have incarcerated family members who are dealing with COVID-19?
I heard that sentiment time and time again. I think especially for Karen, you know, she's a mom. And when your child is sick, you are able to take care of them. So that, and she can't, right? She can't visit. She doesn't know what's going on. She has no access to his medical records. So I think that feeling of helplessness is what I heard echoed throughout many families. You know, they feel like the pleas for help are falling on deaf ears. And so, I haven't seen any movement from the BOP since I've reported this story. No changes to their conditions. Just yesterday, I was hearing again of somebody who had recently tested positive and only getting Tylenol. So things like this are continuing. And even since I reported the story 2 weeks ago, we've seen another 50 cases. So this pandemic is not under control at the BOP.
Karen Yee is a reporter covering New Jersey for WNYC and Gothamist. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're not just seeing major COVID-19 outbreaks in Fort Dix prison. Cases have been popping up across the United States since the pandemic began back in March. Now we're going to zoom out and get an update on the national picture of COVID-19 in our nation's prisons and jails with Lauren Brinkley Rubenstein, an assistant professor of social medicine at UNC Chapel Hill and the head of the COVID-19 Prison Project. Lauren, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So how quickly has COVID-19 spread in the prison population compared to the general population?
It spread very quickly. At the very beginning of the pandemic, we saw cases skyrocketing in prisons and jails across the country. You know, 7 of the 10 largest single-site cluster outbreaks currently are in jails and prisons. About 10% of the incarcerated population has been infected with COVID-19, and we see that the the gap between the general population and the incarcerated population in terms of rates continues to rise.
We've been talking a lot about vaccine development and now implementation and distribution here in the United States. And so far, it's recommended that corrections staff get vaccinated before incarcerated people. What's your thought on that?
Well, first, I'd just like to say that I think it's really important that we're having these conversations and that these recommendations are considering incarcerated people and staff at all. I think that in some ways is unprecedented. I do worry, though, that staff are being prioritized above incarcerated people. In some settings, it makes some sense, right? So in prisons, there tends to be a pretty stable incarcerated population, and staff are really the people who are moving in and out. If we think about jails, 11 million people churn through our country's jails each year. And so that same issue of communication, in essence, between jail settings and the community exists for people who are incarcerated in local jails. And so I think there just needs to be a little bit more nuance to the conversation. And I would argue that people who are incarcerated ought to also be considered in phase one.
Let's talk about the ethics of that. Incarcerated folks lose a lot of their rights when they are incarcerated. Are they able to, for example, say they are not interested in taking the vaccine? Would it have to be mandated for the population? What are the rights of incarcerated people when it comes to a vaccine?
The rights of people who are incarcerated to write are diminished, and there are lots of ethical issues that come up when you're thinking about the concept of consent in prisons and jails. But what I would say is that incarcerated people ought to have the same rights when it comes to vaccines, certainly, than the general population. So they ought to have the right to refuse a vaccine. And prisons and jails have to think about implementation, the challenges that are inherent in these facilities, and think about how to overcome many of those challenges.
To your earlier point about the difference between jails and prisons, prison populations tend to be more stable. Those are people who have actually been convicted and sentenced of their crimes. Jails, on the other hand, not so stable. People could be in and out for a couple days to weeks to months, depending on their ability to pay for their bail. So with a vaccine that needs, at least right now, that needs high storage capacity in terms of very cold storage facilities and also two doses, at least in this iteration, is that even possible to have a vaccine in a jail versus in a prison?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You're right that the average length of stay in jails is very short. I think that it's going to require robust collaboration between departments of health and the jail entities. And so I think, you know, we've really gotten our feet underneath us relevant to contact tracing and being able to find people in the community when they've had an exposure. And I think much of the lessons that we've learned relevant to contact tracing could really be applied to trying to find people in the case if they are released in the community. And so it really underscores the importance of, you know, if jails are going to start the process, then departments of health have to be at the table and have to also be able to find people in the community if they're released.
Lauren Brinkley Rubenstein is an assistant professor of social medicine at UNC Chapel Hill and the head of the COVID-19 Prison Project. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Two runoff elections in Georgia next month will decide control of the U.S. Senate. In November, neither Republican incumbent Kelly Loeffler nor Democratic challenger Raphael Warnock secured enough votes to win the election. And a second Senate race between Republican David Perdue and Democrat John Ossoff is headed to a runoff as well. Now political organizations are trying to woo voters in the state, particularly Latino voters, the number of which is growing. And although the majority of Latino voters in Georgia voted for Democrats in the 2020 election, conservatives are pushing to win over those voters for the Republican candidates. Marcela Valdez is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and she joins me now. Marcela, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what does the population of Latinos look like in Georgia? Who are we talking about here?
There are about 1 million Latinos now living in Georgia, and about 8% of Georgians now speak Spanish in their home.
And are we talking about Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, Cubans, Dominicans? Who are we talking about?
In Georgia, the makeup of the Latinos is actually mostly Mexican-American, which makes it very different from Florida, which is mostly a Caribbean, Puerto Rican, Cuban, and South American population. In Georgia, we're talking about people who have come in from other parts of the United States or directly from Mexico, usually to work either in the agricultural industry, especially the poultry industry, or in the carpet industry, or in construction. And one thing that might be important to know about this population is that they were really recruited, a lot of them, to come to Georgia for working in jobs. So there was recruitment in Mexico, companies recruiting people from Mexico to come finish construction jobs, particularly, for example, before the 1996 Summer Olympics in Georgia, and also to come work in the poultry factories.
Was this a vote that was decisive in 2020 in the presidential election, now that the Georgia votes have been counted?
It's possible. I mean, the margin between Biden and Trump was less than 13,000 votes, and there were 160,000 Latino votes cast in Georgia. So how those broke off, I mean, you can't ever definitively say, oh, this 13,000 votes were Latinos, or they were African Americans, or they were suburban mothers. But there's a chance that a lot of those were Latino votes that made a difference.
We're talking about the upcoming elections in Georgia with Marcela Valdez from the New York Times Magazine. This is The Takeaway. Marcela, politics in Georgia, in the South, how do they differ from where Latinos have fit historically in the political realm of the United States?
Well, one political scientist I spoke with in Georgia said to me, you know, in the South, for hundreds of years, the history of politics there has really been a black and white story. And this influx of Latinos into the state mixes that dynamic up a bit. So historically, the large majority of whites in Georgia have voted Republican, and the large majority of African Americans have voted Democratic. Latinos are a little bit less predictable. So although the majority of them voted for Biden, you can look at their primary participation, because Georgia has open primaries. And you can see, for example, in 2016, about half the Latinos voted in the Republican primary, and about half of them voted in the Democratic primary. That's a 50-50 split. So how they can vote in any particular election, it's hard to get a bead on exactly where they would vote. And I think that means that voter outreach efforts and persuasion efforts are particularly important.
Let's talk about some of those. One of those outreach efforts is coming towards conservative and potentially Republican Latinos in the state, and that's from the Libre Initiative. Let's talk about what they're doing on the ground, Marcela.
So the Libre Initiative is a national organization that was built with help by the Charles Koch Institute. They're now essentially the Latino Spanish-speaking arm of Americans for Prosperity. They have had an office in Georgia for a couple of years now. They've gotten particularly more serious about it in the past year and a half or so. And during the 2016 general election, that office was not particularly active. They didn't endorse any candidates. Libre didn't. Americans for Prosperity did, but Libre didn't. Now, in the runoff, Libre has endorsed Perdue, and they are sending staffers and volunteers from all their other national locations, Florida, Nevada, North Carolina, for example, coming in to knock on doors and to make phone calls that target Latino conservatives to help turn them out for the runoff election in January.
How effective? I mean, it'll be hard to tell until there's actually an election here. But do those efforts appear to be gaining any traction right now?
It's hard to say. If it's too soon to say whether these efforts are gaining traction. But what I can say is that I think that in the past, their efforts have made a pretty significant difference. They were very active in Florida this year, calling conservatives in the Miami-Dade area, in the southern Florida area, and also up near Orlando. Their efforts helped elect several people. They were in the Florida State House, And so I think that they have a very good track record of, one, identifying Latinos who would be sympathetic to their message, which is very important because those Latinos might be less than a majority. So finding the right people that they want to hear their message and then motivating those people to actually go out and cast votes.
Marcela, I know we've been talking about the Libre initiative, the conservative efforts here to get Latinos out to vote. What about liberal and progressive groups in the state? What have they been doing?
Well, in terms of targeting Latinos, the other organizations that I looked at in Georgia were nonpartisan organizations. I mean, Libre is technically a nonpartisan organization, but they are conservative issues-oriented one. These other two nonpartisan organizations that I was looking at, the Latino Community Fund and the Georgia Association of Elected Officials, don't have any policy platforms that they're trying to push. And so they are really working hard to turn out Latinos. And in fact, they are a big part of the reason why so many Latinos are registered to vote in Georgia now. Since 2008, the number of Latinos registered to vote in Georgia has more than doubled. And that is in large part because of these efforts of these two organizations. But they are not trying to turn out either progressives or conservatives. They're just trying to increase Latino participation in Georgia politics.
And Marcela, as we know, with increased participation, particularly of communities of color, there often comes voter suppression. Have we seen that in the state of Georgia with Latino voters in particular?
I did hear especially about one law that was really affecting Latinos in the state. Whether its intention was discriminatory, I can't say, but its effect certainly is. It's the exact match procedure for voter registrations in Georgia. And for example, that means that if you have two last names, as many Latinos do, if your last name is, say, Valdez Lopez, and on your driver's license, it says Valdez hyphen Lopez. And when you register to vote, you just write Valdez space Lopez. Then your voter registration could be rejected because of a hyphen means that it's not an exact match. And that law then has a disproportionate effect on people who have non-standard American last names. And so that it's gotten to the point that Galeo, for example, now goes to naturalization ceremonies and they get people to register to vote and they staple their naturalization copies of their naturalization papers with their voter registration so that they can't be rejected because they have proof of citizenship there.
Marcela Valdez is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Marcela, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today we're taking a look at how the pandemic has affected our romantic relationships. And boy, we heard a lot of stories from our listeners that ran the gamut. For some, the pandemic has helped strengthen your relationships and has even provided new opportunities for love.
Hello, this is Jan from Seattle in Washington. So when the pandemic started, we had been in a relationship for a year with my girlfriend, and I feel like having to spend time together and be in close proximity and spend more time together just brought us closer, and we got to learn a lot about each other. So it's been mostly positive when it comes to relationship.
This is Sally from San Francisco. I'm retired, but my husband is still working outside the home. We've been married for 18 years and are very happy, but I am so glad we are not cooped up together in our small apartment 24/7.
Hey, this is Charlie from Seattle. I stopped seeing people and I stopped having sex until October 2020, about. I then met someone online that works in an isolated environment, so it kind of worked out real well. you know, our first date, we wore masks and we walked around a park and it was great. So, you know, after that, things just got better. But we've taken a pause from in-person visits because of how bad it's been getting. It's not so bad with distance walks or FaceTime. And hopefully vaccines will be in high enough stock when we continue things later.
For others, though, the pandemic has pushed relationships to their breaking points and has highlighted our desire for physical contact.
I'm David from Point Reyes Station, California. And has the pandemic affected my relationships? Are you kidding? I haven't hugged anybody in 7 months. Well, actually, in the last month, I took 3 bold chances. I hugged 3 different people. We faced away from each other as much as possible. Sad, but a little human contact. It's awful.
This is Julia from Clayton, California. Yes, I have no romantic life and would love a relationship, but just gave up during the pandemic. The dating sites were a complete joke. I really miss romance and intimacy, but you need to date someone long enough to like them enough and trust them to get to that point. I'm teaching online full-time and have a house full of animals, and I say my prayers at night to meet someone perfect for me someday. Thank you and have a great day.
Hi, my name is Rihanna. I'm calling from Tacoma, Washington. I am preparing to pick up my husband from the airport. He's been gone for 9 months, and we are going to drop him off at a hotel where he can quarantine for 2 weeks, and we're going to be getting virtual counseling because the pandemic has driven a wedge between us or worsened things that were already problematic in our marriage. I'm hoping that we can come out of it, but we have argued so much and seen things so differently that I'm not sure if it's going to work.
Hi, my name is Marceline Brown. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. I was just getting over a relationship when the pandemic hit. I just gotten the courage to start dating, and then this. The difficulty is I'm just over 50, and though I desire having a partner, I just cannot see myself taking the risk. It's just one more thing that makes me feel even lonelier and honestly just hopeless about having a partner at all.
Hey there, it's Karen from Auburn, California. Not that Karen, but the nice Karen. So just wanted to clear that up first. How's our love life? It's awful. It's non-existent. With my 17-year-old son home in online learning right now, we're with him 24/7 since March. The time ticks slowly. When you just can't abstain any longer and you got to man up and flat out tell him, we're going to be busy for a while and do not disturb. And then that's that. He knows what we're doing and it kind of takes the wind out of your sails and it's not fun anymore. But, you know, we love our son and what can you do? Anyways, send help. We're in crisis.
And for those of us that are single, the pandemic has completely upended how we think and approach dating and sex as we balance our personal safety and health with our desire for intimacy and physical touch. I'm joined now by Helen Fisher, biological anthropologist and author of Anatomy of Love and the chief scientific advisor to the dating site Match.com. Helen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also with us is Lex Brown James, licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy. Lex, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Lex, love in the time of the pandemic has been brutal. What are some ways that that you've seen things work or not work for folks? What are you hearing?
Oh, I'm hearing the same type of brutality that we just heard from so many of the amazing listeners that called in and shared. My practice has soared as far as couples either looking to reconnect and rekindle and maintain, or for couples looking to rededicate themselves to each other. So we're seeing that mental health and therapy supports are very, very high. Me and my colleagues are very, very busy trying to support folks in their relationships. So we're trying to give people grace and also build upon values of intimacy within couples and then build mutual respect.
So Lex, you're working with the people who are together, but Helen, you're a chief scientist over at Match.com who's working with people who are trying to get together, those of us out there in the, or maybe in the dating world, in the single world. What effect is this having on dating, Helen?
Well, strangely enough, it's actually having a very good effect. I hate to say that, but it is. First of all, my data comes from studying 50,000 Americans based on the U.S. Census. So every year I poll about 5,000 Americans. We do not poll the match members. This is a national representative study. And our last study came out just in August, and it was all about the pandemic. And as we find, people are, well, what we're seeing is the rise of a new stage in the dating process. Prior to the pandemic, people were meeting on the internet. That's all the internet does is introduce you, and then going out and meeting in person. And now we see the rise of video chatting. They're meeting on the internet, then doing the video chatting, and then going out in person. And as a result, what they say is that they're spending more time getting to know somebody. They're having more meaningful conversations. They're being more self-disclosure, which does lead to intimacy. They're being more honest, more transparent, less obsessed with looks, and much more interested in finding a partner who's got a full-time job and is financially stable. So we're seeing the rise of intentional dating. People are truly looking for a partner now, and they've got a new way to do it that is actually safe. I mean, when you go out with somebody for the first time, I mean, you got to deal with sex, you got to deal with money, you got to get all dressed up. Whereas they're now using this video chatting as a way, a vetting process to decide whether they even want to go out with somebody. So we're going to see fewer first dates. They're going to be more meaningful because they already know who this person is. And we're going to see people kissing fewer frogs.
Oh, well, that's good news for single folk. Now, Lex, you're working with couples. What are some things that are keeping couples together in this moment? And what are some things that are forcing just the end of a relationship? Is it relationships that were already not so great that are just being exacerbated in this moment? Or is it the pandemic creating new problems?
So it's a both and here, right? We are seeing there was studies out of Indiana University that talked about mothering and how mothers who are now being forced back into the home full time as caregivers because of being furloughed, because of losing their jobs due to the pandemic, are reporting increased amounts of stress when those children are elementary age versus toddlers and little people who did not go to school before. Those parents haven't necessarily seen a shift. We're also seeing that some couples do have the privilege where they're given the chance to spend a lot of time together. And for those couples, if the relationship wasn't that great before, now we're starting to see those stressors start to impact the relationship effects again. And it's hard. I don't know if I really like you anymore. When you were at work, it was a little bit easier to spend these 3 or 4 hours in the evening together, but now we're spending 8 hours together and you're that person that I don't even like in email. So that's really hard. We're also seeing an increase with, of course, domestic violence and abuse. So because the world is not open and people don't have access to as many resources and policies have changed on what's open and what's accessible, it's harder to get out of relationships where those power dynamics can be destructive. On the other hand, my own practice, I've seen people rededicated to their relationships. So they're noticing like, oh, we're together all the time and we thought we'd be having sex all of the time and we finally get time to spend with one another. And some people are really leaning into that of, this is what it's like when we're not ripping and running. This is what it's like when we just get to focus on one another. We see increased touch of kissing, hugging, cuddling, being together, even if it's not direct intercourse. And that has been a real reprieve. I've even had people say, I want to stop cheating on my partner and be in this relationship fully. How do I stop doing that? So that is the positive of folks who are being forced together. Oh, I was going to say the last part of that is in that privilege of being able to be with your partner, we're also seeing folks who don't have that privilege, where their partner is still out working or they're gone for 4 or 5 days and then needing to quarantine. And they're starting to pick up some romance and intimacy because they're missing their partners. And they're like, I want to be with you. I want to talk with you. And they're starting to rekindle romance based on getting to know each other again.
Helen, a lot of the calls that we're getting, particularly for those folks who are uncoupled, are really talking about missing touch, missing sex, missing that physical intimacy. Is there a safe way to approach that now?
Well, I mean, I know that from the studies I've done with Match that about 20% of singles really, I mean, they all want to go out and start dating again. They all do. It's, you know, I study love. I put people in brain scanners. It's a basic brain system. It's a drive. It's a very primitive drive to love and to be loved. And something like about 20% of them still want the social distancing, still want to be very cautious about who they touch and kiss, still insist that both people wear masks. But I think what they're doing now with this video chatting is really getting to know somebody so that by the time they go out, they've already decided, I trust this person, I like this person, I'd like to go forward with this person, I know that they're safe because they've been in quarantine and so have I. And so they're working it out. And I would like to go back to one thing that Les said that's so important. You know, the fact that this lockdown has created a lot of people breaking up, but also a lot of people finding each other again and getting together. And just as an anthropologist, you know, we weren't built for 24/7. I mean, for millions of years, we lived in these little hunting and gathering groups, and both men and women went out every day, or sometimes we're out for several days hunting or gathering or seeing friends in other communities. So it does put tremendous stress on people. And just as she said, it's going to really push you to be imaginative in how you get along with somebody, get to know them better, fall back in love with them if it's a long-term partnership, or break up and find somebody new.
I want to talk a little bit about those breakups in just a minute. But Lex, let's talk about the sexual connection and romantic relationships and you know, relationships that are actually working. I mean, we heard from one of our callers, Karen, who said, frankly, she doesn't have the space to be intimate with her partner, to have sex with her husband. So what do you recommend to couples who are just trying to find space for that intimacy?
So, oh my goodness, yes. I completely empathize with Karen, with all of the folks. I also want to highlight teenagers are feeling this as well. So people often will dismiss teenage love or teenage connection. Also elderly folks and polyamorous folks, right? So not being able to meet with their partners. But exactly what Helen said on the sexuality end, we want people to get creative. New York City's health department came out with this whole list of COVID sex guidance, basically. And it says, maybe you're going to avoid kissing, right? When you're either first initially meeting somebody, if you're not sure about their quarantine status, we're going to possibly wear a face mask or a covering. We're going to try and do things a little bit different. Maybe we're going to make things a little kinky. So we're going to try and be creative with sexual positions. We might even use maybe physical barriers. And we've really started to tell people to spice things up. So maybe there's a sexy text message from the kitchen when somebody else is in the living room. And it's like, hey, babe, can I send you a not safe for work text message right now? And it's like, well, I'm on Zoom in front of the CEO of my company. No. However, I would love to see it later. Or please send that right now. And we're starting to increase that flirting and that teasing. So that building of arousal is throughout the day or throughout the week. And I personally am a fan favorite of scheduling intimacy. I know it sounds boring and drab, but it can really give you something to look forward to. If you know that your kid is going to go ahead and knock out at 2:30 and they're going to take a nap for 20 minutes, maybe that's when you're planning and you and your lover have that on your calendar. So we're looking for innovative ways to get it in. If your partner is home and your teenager decides to go for a ride on their bike for that physical activity that's required, that is your time. All hands on deck. Everybody get it going. And you've been building up that sensuality all throughout the day or all throughout the week or all throughout the weekend as well.
Talking about building up that sensuality, I wonder, Helen, if that is actually leading to more excitement, particularly among people who are meeting and those having sex for the first time who might feel, you know, that this is something that's illicit. This is something that, you know, we're not supposed to be in contact with others or particularly indoors with others. And so is that sort of heightening the experience, the sort of excitement slash danger perhaps around these intimate connections right now?
Well, all the data shows that, you know, very rapid stress drives up the dopamine system and can really trigger sexuality. But long-term stress tends to dampen the dopamine system and probably also the testosterone system, probably dampening your sexual drive. So I'm with Lex. Come up with something that's new, original, different. I love the fact that she said to schedule things. I've been saying that for years, and people are always so grumpy about that. I do think that it's true. And but back to the thing, you know, we are mammals. I mean, this is not going to kill our drive to make love. It's not going to kill our need for physical touch. These are basic parts of the human brain. As soon as we get this virus under control, people are going to be right back at, and I think actually they're going to have new experiences, as Les said. I mean, they're going to expand their horizons in the bedroom and also expand their ability to connect with others.
Lex, do you see that? We've got about a minute left in the segment. Do you see the future of this pandemic really affecting the future of romantic relationships going forward? Or are people just going to forget all about it once we have a vaccine?
I completely expect a baby boom once we have a vaccine. And I do think it's going to change. People are really getting to know each other quite a bit more, as Helen said earlier. So I do think it's going to change for the future and ideally for the better.
So another thing that people are going through during this pandemic are breakups. And those can be, if you want to talk about 2020 being a dumpster fire year and then adding on top of that the end of a relationship, whether it was short term or long term, and just feeling really sad about that. I mean, how do you counsel people through the end of a relationship, particularly at a time like this when it feels like the relationships that we have are so critical?
Mm-hmm. That is honestly why some people are choosing to hang on to relationships not so great for them, because they're afraid of being alone and not being able to find another person. For a couple of folks, I have definitely recommended that they turn internally to their friend circle, right? So that that friend that maybe you are lightly flirty with, maybe you talk about what that might look like to have a no strings attached or to build a flirtatious bond or exchange intimate stories with, or maybe even mutually masturbate on camera, like whatever floats your boat. And really it does come down to safety. So in a breakup, are you cohabitating? Does this mean that you potentially become housing insecure because you're breaking up, right? Who wants to look for an apartment and a house during a pandemic? So for those individuals who are losing relationships, it's one, how does this behoove you? How does this take care of yourself? Are you going to be able to be safe, meet your needs, pay whatever bills that you have? And then two, remembering that we're not vacuums. We don't exist just solely by ourselves. And it might look to what are some of those relationships that might have fallen by the wayside that I need to rekindle to start to build up some community and support.
You're talking about non-romantic relationships, right? In that rekindling,
right?
Like folks that maybe, you know, you hadn't been in touch with for a while.
Right. Or some of those things where you might have had that slight flirtation, but you chose to go a different direction. So it's definitely okay to circle back to be like, hey, you know, I remember us meeting at the grocery store and I was really interested, but I was tied up at the time and I'm actually not tied up anymore. Are you still single, dating? What's your situation? And taking some of that slightly risky initiative. And if they reject you, just being sure that it's not about you personally, it's really about them taking care of themselves and them setting their own boundaries. And saying, like, thank you for taking care of yourself. I appreciate you letting me know. And I'm around if anything changes.
That's really evolved, Lex, in many ways, because I've asked two friends of mine who are out dating and have been dating during the pandemic how it's going. And one of them said something that stood with me. She said, it's going just the way it was going before the pandemic. You know, people are still kind of flaky and there's still sort of, you know, this uncertainty for a lot of folks. And so I think it's really powerful, the advice that you're giving people to still take a chance anyway, because I thought things would get better. I thought, you know, people would start taking things much more seriously and saying, this is really, you know, a critical time. And it seems like friends of mine are saying, not so much.
Oh, yeah. We have to hold hope. I think that's part of what I get to do in my own practice is hold hope for others. But as singles, what I'm finding is people are really, as we talked with Helen before, they're really putting themselves out there on apps. They're swiping on people they might not have swiped on before the pandemic. And so with that being more open, you're going to have more positive hits than you will have dismisses. And that's part of the risk in it of really putting yourself out there. And that's where we're seeing the vulnerability. And from that vulnerability comes intimacy and closeness.
Well, I think that's wonderful advice. And I really appreciate you for it. I have to say, it was very inspiring. I'm now following you on Twitter and very excited. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Not a problem. Thank you. I will definitely be your wing woman when you need it. Let me know.
Thank you, Lex. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a great rest of your day.
Lex Brown James is a licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy. And Helen Fisher is a biological anthropologist, senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute, and chief scientific advisor to the dating site Match.com. Helen and Lex, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Mary from Brooklyn. We've been together for 15 years, but not married, and the pandemic has caused us to talk all the time about our future and how secure we are. It has also, however, reinforced my feeling that we are solid as a partnership. We spend basically all day, every day, working and living together now that we're both working from home, and we just fit. Real friendship and shared interests seem more than ever to be key. It's very sweet if it weren't for the anxiety of being in pandemic purgatory.
Hello, this is Steve calling from West Orange. And the answer is, Lord, yes. Continuing a developing relationship requires a whole series of compromises and often real-world disconnects to make the more cautious partner comfortable. But this is the nature of relationships.
Hi, this is Mark Mannheimer. I'm calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. What our current reality has shown me is that I really would like to have someone in my life and be willing to be more vulnerable soon, I hope.
All right, folks, another one in the books for us on The Takeaway. Amy Walter is with you tomorrow with our politics show. And let me tell you about who helps me make this show for you every week. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Our digital editor is Polly Irungu. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Jackie Martin and Jose Olivares were our line producers this week. And our producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, Amber Hall, and Patricia Jacob. Vince Fairchild is our engineer and board op. Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. And David Gable is our executive assistant. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.